Great. Thanks. And thanks for, you made it through to the end. I don't think I've ever given the last paper before, though it's not been sort of a four-day odyssey or anything, in any case. So, starting in January of 1926, and for over a year, a succession of fruiterers, fruit sellers, an actual word, in the North London boroughs of Hampstead, Haverstock Hill, and West Hampstead found themselves in police court warding off accusations of selling poison apples. And I'm trying to develop some sort of Sleeping Beauty thing here, but I haven't gotten there yet. Dr. F.E. Scrace, Medical Officer of Health for Hampstead, and Frederick Hudson, fruit inspector for the borough, explained that they had bought imported American Jonathan apples with a blue-gray deposit on them that turned out to be arsenic. Several people had got sick. As the scare unfolded, confusion abounded. Could the arsenic be washed off or wiped off with a dry cloth? Or had it bonded with the skin of the apple? Were the levels of arsenic to be found on apples even dangerous to human health? Should fruit sellers be held responsible for this? Barrister George Corner, representing some of these fruit sellers, argued that his clients could only say that they did not and could not possibly be expected to know anything about the matter, and that had they known that arsenic was on the apples, they would, of course, not have sold them. Higher up the food chain, trade bodies accused the press of making exaggerated and even absurd statements. Bravado here, I think, likely hiding worry. As an English group of apple growers remarked, though English apples were not affected, the chief difficulty lay in the fact that the British consumer did not know the British apple from the foreign one. You could say a number of things about this story. For what I want to do today, I wanted to stress the connection I think it shows between human bodies living, working, and eating literally almost on the opposite side of the world from each other. These apples came from the west coast of the U.S. in Washington State. The sickened bodies of Londoners paralleled the toxic bodies of American farm workers, exposed not only to arsenate of lead sprays, the source of the arsenic, but to a variety of other pesticides and fungicides. And together, I think they demonstrated the ways in which global capitalist markets for food were made out of bodies. So what do I mean by saying markets were made out of bodies? And basically, I'm interested, more broadly, I'm interested in markets, and in particular markets for food as historical and cultural phenomenon. And elsewhere, I've discussed this more fully, but here, just to sort of make the point that markets are not naturally occurring phenomenon, as they sort of, I think they get talked about in the press and other areas a lot. They need to be made out of human actions. They need to be made out of physical infrastructure. They need to be made out of government policies, out of culture, out of the environment. And I'm going to suggest here they need to be sort of built out of bodies. So in this paper, I want to explore how and to what extent human bodies are part of the raw material of market making. How are bodies used to build markets? What happens to bodies when they become part of markets? And my case study then is the sale of Nova Scotian apples in Britain before World War II. I'm going to suggest two broad points. One is that the manipulation of bodies has been important, if not crucial, to the building of global markets for apples. So the manipulation of bodies is part of the building of markets. And two, I'm going to suggest that building a global market for apples required that the body be thought of, be discursively constructed as something separate from, as something kind of sealed off from its environment. But then in fact, if we look at sort of the bodies in the building of the markets, we can see that the walls between body and environment were thin indeed. And I'm going to organize this by examining kind of two types of bodies. There's actually four in the written paper, and I might say a little bit more about something else at the end. But I'm going to look at toxic bodies and nourished bodies. And so toxic bodies first, and I've actually forgotten what I have up here. Okay, I'm not there yet. Toxic bodies first. So on the one end of the global apple chain was the bodies of Nova Scotia farmers. The first half of the 20th century, around 75% of apples produced in Nova Scotia's Annapolis Valley, which is sort of the main producing region in Nova Scotia, were exported to Britain. So Nova Scotia apples were a global commodity. They were produced for export for the most part. The Annapolis Valley, though, interestingly, was not a region of large-scale specialized apple production. The census of 1939 found 2,509 apple growers in the Annapolis Valley. 53% of these owned 8 acres or less. And most of these small farms were, in fact, mixed farms. So farmers were producing apples as a cash crop, but they were also sold milk and eggs. They butchered and sold hogs. They grew food for their families. And I have no idea how this fits into sort of the scientific research in Ottawa, but I'd like to figure that out. Now, Nova Scotians had long grown apples. In the past, I think one of the virtues of apple orchards had been that they had looked after themselves to a great extent. And a fair bit of the crop gets turned into sort of cider and sort of in the early days. But producing for the British market, though, meant you had to make apples that could be eaten out of hand, they would say. And also meant competition with growers from around the world, of course. And this meant new kinds of work in order to make a perfect global apple. Okay, so in order to make an apple that was shaped and colored like a typical apple of its variety, that was free of spots and blemishes, global apples then, sort of the sort of typical global apple or global apple trees, I guess, had to be pruned, for instance, starting in January, which I can only imagine was quite cold. Global apple trees needed to be thinned, so immature apples were cut off with a pair of scissors so that the tree would produce less but larger apples. Later on, you get sort of chemical methods of doing this, but 150-pound apple barrels needed to be hoisted onto horse-drawn wagons and put onto Dominion Atlantic Railway cars or onto steamers bound for London or Liverpool or Glasgow. But above all, I think global apples needed to be sprayed. And dousing apple trees with pesticides and fungicides was increasingly necessary for those who hoped to sell into global markets. And I think this is the major new activity that came from the advent of the global apple. So the problem of spotted, cracked, and crooked apples, typically produced by apple diseases such as apple scab or bitter rot, could only be dealt with through spraying, modernizers and government experts claimed. And here we see a report from the Nova Scotia School of Horticulture showing you the difference between sprayed apples and unsprayed apples on the right there. Sprays included lime sulfur, which was a solution of quicklime and sulfur, arsenate of lead, which we already talked about, and Paris Green were both popular pesticides based on arsenic. They would also use a kerosene emulsion, which was a sort of a hard soap and coal oil in solution. And the bodies of farm workers were then exposed to these chemicals, and exposed to these chemicals in two ways. First of all, many farmers would have mixed these on their own. It's pretty clear that there's sort of explicit instructions, and I think it's pretty clear that there's a lot of sort of mixing up of these pesticides on farms themselves. And farm workers were also exposed, of course, when applying the sprays. And here we see, spraying, it's sort of a typical spraying from 1940. This is from the Nova Scotia Fruit Growers Association Museum. And so we can see them spraying with these sort of long, these long wands or hoses, and they're wearing sort of rain gear, which would be their protection. And this is not even, you didn't even always see this, or not even that often see this in the photographs I've seen. It's hard to know the effect of this, okay? And this is one area that I need to work on, and any thoughts on this, I mean, any thoughts at all are welcome, and any thoughts on this would be interesting. I'm sort of trying to puzzle out how do you figure out what's the effect of this. So arsenical pesticides like arsenate of lead and Paris Green, according to sort of contemporary sources, accumulate in the body. Over time, they can act as carcinogens or mutagens. They can possibly cause birth defects, according to sort of some more modern sources I've looked at on the effects of these. However, when taken orally, they're very toxic. But when inhaled or absorbed through the skin, there doesn't seem to be, at least according to the sources I've seen, nobody seems to know exactly how toxic they are when they're inhaled or taken through the skin. Sulfur is highly poisonous when it comes in contact with skin, so maybe when you're mixing it, right? It's much less toxic when inhaled. Kerosene has a low toxicity when inhaled, but over the long term can cause lung damage and is a neuro toxin. So hard to sort of figure out exactly what's going on, particularly with sort of individual farm workers. Certainly the bodies of farm workers move through toxic environments in their fields and in their back sheds. And certainly their bodies, I think certainly we could say, likely took on some of that toxicity. I think I need to do some sort of further research into sort of medical records. And I mean, I think this part of the research is drawing me into medical history, which is something I've never really dealt with before. So possibly obituaries, I don't know, could possibly confirm some of this. What's clear, I think, is that the growth of the global apple in Nova Scotia meant that farm workers lost the ability to protect their body from toxic chemicals. Now, I want to qualify this a little bit in saying that unlike workers on banana or tea plantations, for instance, small farmers working on their own farm in the valley could choose to avoid, limit, or manage this work, right? They could choose not to spray, and studies show clearly that actually quite a number of valley fruit apple producers chose not to spray, up to a half, I think, and you see in studies in the 1930s. But if they chose not to spray, then they're choosing a lower income on their apples. They're choosing to risk getting apples like this, which are obviously less marketable on a global market. All right. Oh, okay. So toxic bodies, now nourished bodies. I want to talk about nourished bodies, because bodies, of course, did more than just perform work and receive toxins. Bodies need food, and the whole point of this global system, of course, was to satisfy bodily needs for food. The late 1910s saw the discovery of vitamins, and vitamin C becomes known or is talked about in the literature I've looked at as the anti-scurvy vitamin. By the early 1920s, the public had caught on, interest in vitamins became widespread, even fashionable. And British people were told to eat protective foods, so they increasingly drank milk, ate canned peas, and took advantage of the fact that fresh apples could now be got year-round from various parts of the empire. The discovery of vitamins meant that the interests of public health could now be seen to align with the interests of those who wanted to sell apples. So the Eat More Fruit campaign, which was a, and this is not actually a poster from the British Eat More Fruit campaign, but I have a great image of a sort of a decorated truck with people and the things, and I can't find it. But anyways, but this gives you an idea. This is from New Zealand. So the Eat More Fruit campaign put on by the British Fruit Trades Federation, which was a campaign of posters, newspaper ads, and decorated Eat More Fruit caravans, which was entering into its fourth year in 1927. The alignment between sort of public health and selling apples was not always perfect. So, for instance, research turned up that a variety of apples called Bramley Seedling were high in vitamin C. But from the point of view of Nova Scotia producers, they didn't produce Bramley Seedling apples, so it didn't really help them very much. British Columbia growers, there was this interesting sort of controversy or moment where British Columbia growers found that their larger apples did not fit well. They were producing these sort of large apples. They didn't fit well with British tastes. So one British correspondent explained that one did not, and if I could do an English accent, I would do it. But, one did not require a large apple in the morning as it would spoil one's breakfast. And again, the small apple was required for dessert after dinner when the appetite had been almost satisfied. More seriously, Canadian apples may have not been the best way to get vitamin C. Canadian apples were typically stored, sometimes for several months, in order to come on the British market in winter. This was kind of the market niche that Canadian apples occupied. But vitamin C breaks down very quickly in stored foods. Apples stored for the winter can lose 40 to 50% of their vitamin C. And even in tests done at the time showed a lower vitamin C content in apples the longer distance that they had traveled. So there's also other possible reasons, but it seems more likely that the reason the ones that had come from far away were lower in vitamin C was because of the time it had taken to get there. Also, of course, they risked being sickened by ingesting arsenic. British consumers cut through the fog of conflicting claims and false assurances around this by backing off on buying all imported apples, including those from Nova Scotia. All right, how much time do I have? Okay, I'm in a very, I've got a little bit of a conclusion, but there is a, I also, in the written paper, I say a little bit, and I haven't really developed this very much, about sort of bodies as imperial symbols. So essentially my point here is this is an Empire Marketing Board ad. And in Empire Marketing Board ads, which was an Empire Marketing Board was a British body set up to sell Empire products in Britain. And one of the interesting things about bodies in Empire Marketing Board ads is the British people don't work in Empire Marketing Board ads, right? So the people you see working are people from the Empire. So you will see some white people working in ads about Canada. Mostly you'll see landscapes. You will see more people working from India and Africa and places like this. But I think British bodies are there to be kind of, are the symbol of how they can be nourished by the Empire. And of course, the Queen Annapolisa and the Apple Blossom Princess, which is a long-standing, still existing tradition in the Annapolis Valley of the Apple Blossom Princess. And you could do all kinds of things with sort of, I mean, it's one of the things I notice is that they're associated with the apple blossoms, not with the apples themselves. So clearly here you have, I mean, this is very important to people. And I interviewed a 95-year-old woman who's the oldest surviving Apple Blossom Princess, and she's very, very proud of it. But you can see the way in which their bodies are being used to kind of, you know, I don't want to say promote the industry, that's a bit crude. But anyways, you see where I'm going. But all right, so to the conclusion and discussion. So I said 2 points. I was going to talk about the way that bodies were manipulated to make markets. That point, I think, is fairly clear. That bodies were poisoned, nourished, possibly malnourished, had to perform particular kinds of work. Secondly, I wanted to talk about how bodies were discursively constructed as being separate from environments, and I want to say a little bit more about that here. And I'm drawing on environmental historians of toxins, and in particular the work of Linda Nash, who argues that modernity, the sort of the modern world develops and kind of assumes and then comes to assume this particular idea of the body, that it's essentially pure and self-contained from its environment. So you've got this kind of essentially pure self-contained body, and then external forces kind of penetrate it, right, to cause disease. Germs penetrate this body. This is sort of the model that people are working with. Nutrients, I think we could then say, enter the body to nourish it. And she points out that this is actually quite a new idea, that even in the late 19th century, you can see in the medical literature people assuming that health of bodies has to do with their relationship with the environment. So even in the late 19th century, even in the medical literature, you can see people talking about the way in which bodies react differently to different places, the way in which winds and miasmas and lowlands and uplands and things can affect bodies differently, and that this is really important to human health. And Nash argues, I mean, she doesn't quite go to say that idea is more correct than this sort of body as a unit that gets, you know, penetrated in different ways. But I think she's sympathetic to it. And she argues that it's increasingly clear, it's become increasingly clear that bodies cannot be walled off from their surroundings. So this idea of the body as pure, separate has been important to building modern medicine. And I think probably modern ideas of nutrition, though I need to think through that some more. And I want to argue here kind of to building modern capitalist markets, but it hides the extent to which bodies are part of their environments. And one of the things I see going on here is that building a global market for food is a process of environmental and bodily change, and the two are working together. Thank you.